You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, A Compassionate Spy, the story of Theodore Hall, a Manhattan Project physicist who passed the atomic bomb secrets to the USSR and was never prosecuted. And Miguel Gavilan Molina reports from the Immigrants March for Citizenship that happened all this weekend. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. Tonight we are broadcasting from KPFA Bay Area, and we are happy to have you along. And we are honored to welcome to these airwaves, welcome back to these airwaves, an old friend of the show and a wonderful journalist, Mr. Dave Lindorf, who has been involved in an extraordinary project. Dave, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Okay, and please speak right up into the phone. I know we had a little problem with Skype.
Are you hearing me well?
I'm hearing you just fine. So,
okay.
Let's, you're, and there's going to be a book coming out that really is going to go even deeper into this story, but you have been engaged for some time, shall we say, in trying to do the story of Ted Hall, really, and Ted Hall and Joan Hall. And ultimately, you finally got a wonderful filmmaker in the form of Steve James, Hope Dreams, Academy Award winner, nominated twice. You managed to get a distributor to distribute a film about a I'm not exaggerating, about a, you'd have to call him a spy who gave the secret to the atomic bomb, to the Soviet Union. And that story is portrayed in this new film. And, well, let's start off here. At 18 years of age, Theodore Hall was the youngest physicist on the Manhattan Project, hired as a junior at Harvard and put to work in Los Alamos in 1944. Okay, fill in this story. Who was Theodore Hall? Tell us a little bit more about him and how he went from Harvard to being one of the key creators of the atomic bomb.
Okay. Ted Hall was a supremely and bizarrely intelligent kid. A child of two Russian, well, the father was a Russian immigrant Jew, and his mother was a second generation Russian immigrant Jew. And Ted, by the time he was 4 years old, was so obviously smart that his 11-year older brother, who was like 15, told his parents, "Look, he needs a special education, and I can give it to him. So I'm going to take over his education from here. This is a 15-year-old kid telling his parents. And they agreed to that rather, you know, forward proposal. And so his brother, who was studying engineering already at CUNY, was teaching Ted math and history and everything else. And Ted, by six, was doing algebra. You know, this is an amazing kid. He graduated. He went to a select high school, Townsend Harris High School, that was a part of the CUNY project, an accelerated school, and graduated in time to go be a student at 14 at Queens College of CUNY, where he got bored and he told his brother, who by then was in Europe as a volunteer in the U.S. Army Air Corps, that he was bored, and his brother told him, you should apply to Harvard. And so but when he was 16, he was admitted to Harvard as a junior and a physics major, which was what he loved. And from there, you know, things moved quickly. He took his physics program, was doing well in it, and his professor Van Fleck, John Van Fleck, that famous astrophysicist, was asked who he would recommend for the Manhattan Project to hire. They wanted four advanced students to help speed up the work there, because they were, you know, they really stripped the universities of physics professors for the Manhattan Project, and the physics departments were having trouble teaching their grad students because they lost all their professors to the Manhattan Project, and which was huge. And he named four students, and one of them was Ted Hall, who by then was 18 and finishing his junior year. And so he got hired, and on January 28th he arrived in Los Alamos, a rising senior, and was put on the pretty quickly onto the plutonium project, where he was working with the implosion system that was required to detonate a plutonium bomb. It was a really baroque system of 32 explosive charges to compress a subcritical mass of plutonium and get a critical explosion. And so that's what he was working on. He knew the inside, that plutonium bomb inside and out. So that's how he got to Los Alamos. Now
he began to participate in the creation of the bomb and in understanding the nature of the philosophy of the driving forces of why
well,
it was being built.
You know, when he said, he was told that the reason they wanted them was they needed to build this bomb before the Germans got it. And it, being a Jewish kid and aware very much of what was happening to Jews in Germany, he was very happy to be doing it. He was kind of a leftist, not a communist. He was just a kid. But he was sympathetic to the fact that, since 43, the Russians were doing all the fighting against the Germans. The British and the Americans weren't even in the fight at that point in Europe. The Americans were fighting in Japan, and in the Pacific, but they hadn't really committed troops to land warfare until 44. So the Russians were doing all the fighting and the dying, and you know, and everybody knew about it. The film shows graphically how popular Russia was among Americans for being carrying this battle, heroic battle against this, the strongest nation in the world, the Germans, and winning. By 1944, the Russians army had smashed the Wehrmacht and they were in retreat. And the U.S. had bombers and the British had bombers flying into Germany, bombing it day and night by fall of 44. And Ted was convinced, as many of the scientists were, that the war was basically over and it was just a matter of time, because Germany was not going to win. It was being defeated, and they certainly were not going to get the bomb because their whole industrial infrastructure was being shattered. So he and many scientists felt like, well, why are we doing this at this point? You know, the Japanese are losing too, and we don't need this. And they were also upset, many of them, that the Russians were being kept out of it, as they were our main ally, and we were trying to keep it all secret from them. So he decided in the fall that all the talk from scientists trying to pressure Roosevelt not to use the bomb and stuff wasn't working, and somebody had to take direct action. So he figured it fell to me to do it. I had to do it. And so he decided to be a spy and give the Russians as much information as he could about the plutonium bomb so that they could get their own and be worried. He was an advanced thinker, and he realized that the U.S. could become a fascist country after the war. He wasn't far off, actually, when you look at the McCarthy period. And he felt like if the U.S. has the bomb and nobody else does, it's going to be a disaster for humanity. And that's why he acted.
So how old was he when he became essentially a super spy and gave the necessary information to the Soviets? How old was he? And say a little bit more about what drove that decision. He had some encounters with General Groves, and there was a real deceit going on, wasn't there?
Pardon?
There was a...
He didn't have any dealings with Groves. Groves was a high up. He ran the whole operation. Right. He probably didn't have a clue who. He probably met Hall, you know, when he would tour the experimental division unit of Los Alamos. But Ted was running. He was at 18. He was a unit leader in the work on the plutonium bomb. But he wasn't like even the head of that project.
He became aware that the policy was about domination, that the idea was...
You're talking about... Yeah, I know what you're talking about. There was a dinner, a famous dinner, hosted by the British scientists who had come over. They called them the British mission. The British atomic mission came over, moved to the Manhattan Project in 43, and 44, and the head of the British mission hosted a dinner for the Americans in September, I believe, of 1944. And at that dinner, Groves was one of the invitees, of course. And during dessert, there was some discussion, you know, how the war was ending, winding down, and the Germans weren't going to get the bomb. And Groves said, well, you realize, of course, that the bomb was never really about attacking Germany. It was about controlling the Soviets. And that was shocking to a lot of people. And it certainly went around the camp. It was not, you know, that Los Alamos was a place where people were allowed to talk about anything inside the fence. And then outside, it was all top secret. So within Los Alamos, that comment, a very shocking comment, rocketed around, I'm sure, and everybody knew about it. And to Ted, that would have been it to know that was what the thinking was, because he knew how powerful this bomb was going to be. And he knew that the U.S. was way ahead of where the Soviets had to be, because they didn't have the resources to do the kind of, you know, Oak Ridge and Hanford construction that the U.S. did and Los Alamos and build a bomb. The Russians never weren't even close to being able to refine enough U-235 to make a bomb during the war. And I think everybody knew that was true, because it was so hard for the U.S. to do it. The U.S. only just got enough for the Hiroshima bomb in time for the Hiroshima bomb. They didn't have any more U-235 at that point. So they used everything they had to make that bomb. So, you know, he knew that the U.S. was going to be like, he knew that they were planning to industrialize the production of the bomb, which was being handmade at that point. And so he knew that they were planning to make a lot of them. And why would they be doing that? Everybody said the Russians won't get the bomb for another 10 years.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Dave Lindorf. He is the key mover and shaker in an extraordinary film, which essentially shows how a young technician working on the bomb at Los Alamos decided that he would become really one of the most significant spies in modern history and give essentially key information to the Soviet Union so that they would be able to co-develop the bomb at the same time. And I want to talk more about that, and I want to bring in, because this is as much a spy thriller as it is a love story, and an amazing love story. So what I'd like to do is, we've got the trailer, and before we bring in Joan Hall, we're going to play a little bit of the trailer. Can you describe what's on the trailer? What we're going to see?
Is it the opening?
I believe so.
The start?
I think
yeah.
so.
We had a tape. The thing is, Ted was dead as of 1999, and so we had a problem with doing a this is a documentary, it's not a drama. And to do a documentary, you need the people, and Ted was dead, and Joan was 91 years old when we started. And she was 93 when we taped her last, and she died just this past June, I'm sad to say, at 94, but very happy with having the film out. In 1998, Ted's lawyer, who he hired when his name was exposed as a spy, in 1995, when the NSA released some of these decrypted Soviet spy cables from the war that they'd been copying and trying to decipher, and it identified him as a spy in 95. So he hired a lawyer, a famous civil liberties lawyer in England, Ben Bernberg, and Ben suggested in 98 that Ted make a tape and tell what he did and why, which he said he would keep in his safe until Ted and Joan were dead, and then he would give it to journalists and historians for the historical record. So we, you know, Joan was still alive, but she had a copy of the tape, and the lawyers couldn't find it, the main copy. She had a copy of it, and she said we could have it. I said, I don't care what, you know, I'm not dead, but they're not going to arrest me now. So yes. So we had Ted at 74 telling what he did and why, and we had some other tapes too that some interviews he did, which had lots and lots of material that never aired, that was quite powerful, and some of it is in the film. So we actually have Ted, talking on film, and he might as well be alive and doing it, you know, for all anyone would know.
Let's listen to the trailer. Let's listen to the trailer. Yeah. We've got that.
This is the trailer that is that he made specifically to be shown after he died.
This is a recording for archive purposes. The idea is to document Ted Hall's activities in connection with his work on the atomic bomb.
I left high school at 15 and went to the University of Chicago. In my third year in the place, and I met Ted. We just went around together.
Ted Hall was a man with a remarkable mind. He was a senior at Harvard at the age of 18. A recruiter from Washington came up.
His mission was to pick up a few very junior physicists to help in the research work at Los Alamos.
Suddenly Ted went all serious and he said, there's something I have to tell you.
He was working on the implosion bomb. It was one of the major secrets of the war.
We have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction.
Something gruesome and horrible was being constructed.
Knowledge should be shared.
They had decided they wanted to get in touch with the Soviets. Ted had passed along the first information of this bomb that would blow up Nagasaki. This speeded up the Soviet development of the bomb by about 5 years.
He did agree to continue. That was when the hunt resumed.
The FBI started following us.
The Rosenbergs were small fish compared to Ted Hall.
The Wunderkind spy. It was very dangerous that the Americans had a monopoly of this weapon.
Did you provide information to the Soviet Union?
What should have been done with Ted Hall?
Shut.
The world has come extremely close to real, actual, total disaster.
What made you do it?
I guess a major factor would be compassion.
Amazing. So say a little bit more. So I was saying
that was actually the trailer. That was the trailer.
That was his voice at the end, though, right?
Yes, that was his voice at the end. So go ahead with your question. I just wanted to clarify that was not the tape that he made in 98.
Sorry about that confusion.
After his death. Yeah. Okay.
Well, talk about the relationship between Joan Hall and Ted Hall. Ted, he felt guilty. He wanted to confess. And that's where Joan stepped in. But they met in college. They were an extraordinary couple. And I think she comes through as a powerhouse. They both really shared this belief that she wasn't crazy about knowing what she knew, but she knew that he did it. She felt he did it for the right reasons, and that was part of this extraordinary love affair. Just talk about their relationship and how this evolved.
Yeah, so she was 17 when she met Ted, and he was 20. Let me say 22, 25, 27. He was 22, so he's older than her. But not, you know, a real old guy. She was not involved in his spying because she was like 15 when he did his spying and didn't know him. She was in Chicago going to high school. But Ted, when he met her, he quickly fell in love with her and she and him. Around the time she was 18, he proposed to her. And said he wanted to. He said, "Joan, I love you. I want to marry you." And she said, "I immediately said yes." And then he got all serious, and he said, "But first, there's something I have to tell you." And then he tells her, "I gave the bond to the Russians, you know." And she says, "Why? What good would that do?" And he told her, you know, because it was dangerous to have one country with the bomb after the war. And so she said, "So you gave it to the Russians?" You know, like, "Oh, you're going to give it to the Russians?" She says. And he said, "I did, right? And I was afraid you might want to bow out." And she said, "I didn't want to bow out." You know, she said, I think she quoted the quote. She says, "Is I to tell you the truth, if he could have shot someone on Broadway, and I would have married him." She just really loved him. But what she did was, you know, in doing that, he said, "You know, you have to keep this secret forever. This is you can't tell anybody, not your mother, and you can't tell anybody." And she did that. For 51 years, they lived together. They had a marriage of 51 years, raised three daughters, and one who sadly was killed by a truck. But she was in her 30s then, and left two, you know, young daughters. But they, you know, aside from that family tragedy, I mean, they raised a family always fear of FBI knocks at the door, and you can imagine the stress that they must have been under, and they stuck it out. It's a love story, and the thing is about Joan, she was absolutely committed to Ted and what he had done, and believed as he did that it would have been a disaster if he hadn't done it, and so she actually saved him at least twice from, you know, sabotaging himself and maybe her too. The first one was with the Rosenbergs, because he felt terribly guilty that the Rosenbergs were being executed for having practically done nothing to do with atomic spying. That was really blown out of proportion. It was David Greenglass, Ethel's brother, who gave a pretty poor drawing of the lens they were using to focus the blasts of the conventional weapons onto the plutonium sphere, to compress it. And they were getting actual detailed drawings of that from Ted. And so, you know, it wasn't anything significant and nothing else, really. In fact, he gave them an erroneous drawing of the bomb to the Russians. So they probably did as much harm as good. But Ted had given them basically the schematics for the Nagasaki bomb.
Right.
So you know, what would Hoover have done to him? We'll never know, because Hoover was stopped from prosecuting him, but by the Air Force. But that's another story. But Joan, he said to Joan, I want to offer my own confession to the Justice Department if they will give clemency to the Rosenbergs. And Joan said, don't you dare. They will double cross you. They won't release them from execution, and they'll execute you and maybe me. And she had a point, because she did help him hide stuff when the FBI brought him and his friend and courier, Saville Sachs, roommate at Harvard, in for questioning, for 3 hours questioning in Chicago, and they stonewalled them. And then suddenly the prosecution dropped within months, and I found out why. But, you know, they certainly could have done the same thing to, like Peter Kuznick, director of the nuclear history program at American University, said, you know, they could have done the same thing to Joan that they did to, and probably would have, to what they did to Ethel, like use her as a bargaining chip or an extortion effort against Ted. If they had arrested his young wife, you know, and he had he had a young daughter at that point, and told him, you know, if you don't confess, they're going to be charged too, you know, or his wife's going to be charged too, he would have folded like a house of cards. He loved her. And right. You know, he was ready to do it. And Joan said, no, you know, that's not going to work, and it'll destroy us and destroy you. And she was right. And in fact, I told Michael Meeropol about this story. And he
had the Rosenberg children. Yes.
Yeah, the older son, and he actually knew them, because he had been doing graduate work and living on the same street as them, and not knowing it. But after his name came out, and Michael was already back in the U.S., he called them up right away and flew over to meet them. And now he's like fast friends with Joan. But he told me, oh yes, Joan was right to do that to Ted. It would have been a disaster if he had offered himself to confess, you know.
That would have worked.
Yeah, he said it wouldn't have worked, and it would have been a disaster for him. So, you know, no hard feelings.
No hard feelings, yeah. Of course, the killing of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, just the way it comes into the film. I was saying, as I spoke to you after I watched it, and it was, you know, it's sort of, you think you've been through it, watching their resistance, and here's this young man who becomes a super spy, gives the Soviets, I guess, the atomic bomb and that was, we should say, of course, that was his concept, really. He was very conscious that this was like this was the beginning of the MAD policy, the mutually assured destruction policy. He felt very strongly that if again, you said this earlier, but it's so important. This is part of his consciousness. He really felt and was right that if only the U.S. had the bomb, they would have ultimately wreaked havoc. If the Russians tried to build one, and would have destroyed the country, half of Russia, to stop them from doing it.
In the film, we document, based on the work by two physicists who wrote a magnificent book called To Win a Nuclear War, the U.S. Plan to bomb the Soviet Union. And that was by Michio Kaku, the astrophysicist who many people know from NOVA and stuff, and Daniel Axelrod, another nuclear physicist who was from University of Michigan. And they wrote this book in the 80s, and it got no attention at all. I think it was published by South End Press. It's phenomenally well documented, and they got documents from the NSC and the Pentagon, some that were declassified, some that they were just given, that show that the U.S. was planning to make 400 bombs, hit 100 Soviet cities, and destroy Russia as an industrial society to prevent it from getting an atomic bomb. And the hard fact is that the U.S. did make did industrialize production of the bomb and did make 400 bombs by 1950. But in August 1949, the Soviets exploded their almost carbon copy of the Nagasaki bomb, and the plans to attack Russia were dropped because they weren't going to be able to do it to have enough of the bombers to carry them into the heartland of the Soviet Union, where a lot of their industrial strength was because of the war, and that, you know, by then the Russians would have what they called A-Day, the Pentagon called A-Day, enough nuclear bombs themselves to offer a significant retaliatory response. And so they just decided it couldn't be done. They couldn't do a preemptive attack. They were going to do it. There's no question that the United States wanted to maintain they were gleeful that they were going to have a free hand with nuclear weapons after the war that would allow them to bully the rest of the world. And they didn't want to lose that. And that's what Ted foresaw. But I want to make a point. He did not anticipate MAD. Nobody would have anticipated MAD, you know, spending trillions of dollars to outcompete each other with nuclear weapons. He thought that surely if there were two countries with the bomb and neither one could use it, that they would decide the rational thing to do, which would be to ban the thing. Yeah, I mean, it's a useless weapon if you can't use it, right? Yeah. And you don't want other people getting it. It wasn't that he wanted nuclear proliferation with all kinds of countries having the bomb. He thought, you know, it would prove that you couldn't, that it was a pointless and horribly dangerous weapon to even have in existence. And you know, he was horribly upset that it turned into MAD. But you know, at the same time, MAD worked. You know, we came very close many times, but let's face it. The fact is, there's been 78 years now and running of no nuclear weapon used since Nagasaki. That's astonishing when you consider that there have been as many as 50,000 or 60,000 nuclear weapons floating around this world, and none of them's been used. Why? Wow. Because everybody knows that it's a murder-suicide pact.
Okay, I got to ask you. Now, Magnolia Films had the courage to back a film that was essentially celebrating, in a way, what you're just describing now, that this young technician, that this visionary was thinking that he could help prevent a global conflagration that would end the world as we know it by becoming a spy and giving the atomic secrets to the Russians. Prosecuted. Go on.
Well, so I stumbled on this story because I wrote an article about Hiroshima, as I often do, and I was looking for a new angle. And I Googled the spies, the eight spies who, you know, basically were in Los Alamos and other parts of the Manhattan Project and gave secrets to the Russians. And why? Who were these people? And when I looked at it, one of the pictures was of a kid. He had a pimply-faced kid. He had pimples on his forehead, on his cheeks. He had, you know, acne. You know, he looked like a high school kid. And he turns out he virtually was, age-wise. And so I read a little about him, and there wasn't that much written about him, but that he wasn't caught intrigued me, and how young he was. And I just thought, wow, you know, that kid deserves a posthumous Nobel Peace Prize, because he stopped the U.S. from having the bomb after the war by itself. And I added Klaus Fuchs, because he also gave an enormous amount to the Russians, a German, English scientist, equally brilliant. And the two of them, because they both gave the information, the same information about the plutonium bomb, gave a very suspicious Soviet Union, a confidence, because they knew that neither of those spies knew each other, because they were running them. And so even though they were both at Los Alamos, neither one knew the other was a spy. And so, you know, that was the reason that they got the bomb so fast, because they really believed it. And Khrushchev, the head of the, Igor Khrushchev, gave Stalin the advice that he said, we have to drop trying to get the uranium bomb. We're not going to get it. And it's wasting our resources. We need to put everything into making this bomb that we now know how to make. And Stalin agreed. And that's how they were able to do it. They just dropped the uranium bomb till later, and which they knew how to make but didn't have the resources to make. So so anyway, the point is that you know, Ted should have gotten the Nobel Peace Prize, but they don't give them to dead people, and I'm not sure that they would give him it anyway. But I got a letter after I published that in Counterpunch. I got a note saying, "Dear Dave, I'm reading your article in Counterpunch about Ted Hall. I'm his widow, with tears in my eyes. I'm his widow, and you're the first journalist who got him." And, you know, I just thought, whoa, I have to get in touch with this woman. And we became pen pals. And I suggested there should be a book, because of what we now know about U.S. plans to destroy the Soviet Union. And it shows the value of what Ted did. And she said, oh, I don't want a book, you know. But, you know, eventually she said, could you do a movie? And I said, I don't know how to do a movie. Like, I could do one, but nobody would ever see it. I know nothing about distribution and fundraising and blah, blah, blah. I'm a print journalist. And so I tried a little, and I just said, nah, this isn't going to happen. And then it hit maybe this brainstorm. I knew Steve James because I was in a movie he made, a brilliant movie called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, about a tiny, tiny bank in Chinatown that was indicted by Vance as the only bank in the United States that was indicted for the mortgage fraud in the fiscal crisis. And it was a terribly racist thing that he did, and it was a total failure. And the film was brilliant. And I just thought, man, if this guy, Steve James, who was delightful and we got along great, and I appeared in it as the reporter telling the national significance of the story, And you know, we got along great, and I was so impressed with him. So I thought, anybody who can do a story about a bank and make everybody cry at the end, and also understand mortgage, you know, mortgage crisis and mortgage fraud, could make a really good movie out of Ted Hall's story. And so Steve comes in. He says, well, it all depends on how compelling a person Joan is, because she's the only one alive. And I said, you got to meet her. She is compelling. So he funded a trip there by me and him and his usual producer, Mark Mitten, and his top videographer, and my son as second camera, and which I covered. And we did 3 days of filming of Joan and her two brothers, and And he took it home, and he said, within days, he said, she's incredible.
You can't even begin to. Now, listen, we're just about out of time, but I do want you to tell me very quickly. She just died this year, but she actually saw the film. At first, she said she didn't want to see it. She made you cut a great deal of her crying.
Oh, no, that was her daughter. That was her daughter. That was her youngest daughter.
Oh, Sarah. I see. Okay. So, but just put a cap on it for now. You got 30 seconds. What do you think is the takeaway from this film?
I would give it the same takeaway that Joan did when she spoke to the audience after the film and they asked the question, said that question. She said, I think what this film shows everyone is that one person can make a difference in the history of the world.
Wow, amazing. Okay, so listen, I want to also tell people that Dave Lindorf has a book about this coming out, Spy for No Country, The Story of Ted Hall, the Teenage Atomic Spy Who May Have Saved the World. That's going to be out in December. Thank you, Dave. Really incredible filmmaking. People should check this film out. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We got to go right to Miguel on the march down south. Stay with us.
This is Miguel Gavilán Molina for Flashpoints on the Pacifica Network. Today, August, Saturday the 5th, 2023, I am here in San Jose, California, at the Mexican Heritage Plaza at a gathering for a pilgrimage, a three-day walk from San Jose to the federal building in San Francisco for advocating for the passage of legislation that addresses immigration reform for immigrant and refugee rights. I'm here this morning with one of the representatives of the City Council, and it's a great pleasure to be here today. Councilman, can you please identify yourself and let us know what brought you here today?
Hello, everyone. This is Councilmember Peter Ortiz with the San Jose City Council. I represent Eastside San Jose on the council. I am here to stand with our brothers and sisters in the undocumented community in their pilgrimage to San Francisco to advocate for immigration reform and for the passing of H.R. 1511, which, if passed, will expand the registry to allow our undocumented brothers and sisters who have DACA, TPS, and even other undocumented people to become citizens here in the United States.
After nearly almost 40 years of inaction by the federal government, you as a city councilman, have you seen any action here within California and the state government trying to advocate for immigration reform?
We definitely have had individuals, elected officials at the state level, advocate federally for our undocumented sisters and brothers. But we've also had a longstanding grassroots movement here in San Jose for immigration reform. I was a part of a coalition that shut down the Golden Gate Bridge last year, where five of us were arrested. And we shut that down to send a message to Vice President Kamala Harris to overrule the parliamentary procedure and allow for immigration reform. So while our United States government is advocating, our Biden is advocating, we are also here on the ground level doing so.
And there's a lot of issues in surrounding immigration reform. But one of the things that today's action focuses on is the whole issue of human rights.
Yes.
Human and labor rights. And that's one thing that sometimes we don't address, because there's roughly, I believe, Councilman, there's something like anywhere from 8 to 12 million immigrants who would qualify if the government, the federal government, would open up its processes and allow people to apply for not just permanent residency, but eventually citizenship. You have one of the largest Spanish-speaking Latino communities next to Los Angeles in the south. San Jose has a metropolis of, you know, Latinos in this area. Have you sensed from your constituents of a concern about this? And does the community deal with backlash or deal with fear of being picked up by ICE? Do people fear going to work and maybe not coming back to their children who are U.S. citizens? Have you experienced any of that in your district?
Absolutely. As you just mentioned, we have one of the largest immigrant populations next to Los Angeles. Here in Eastside San Jose, we are home to Mexicanos, Salvadoreños, Bolivians, South Central Americans, and many of them contribute to our economy greatly. You know, they are our labor force. They are the ones you see in restaurants. They're the ones in these tall buildings cleaning in downtown San Jose. And, you know, they deserve citizenship. They have been here paying taxes, doing their work to contribute to society. And unfortunately, you know, our government has not acknowledged their economic contributions. There's no question that the city of San Jose's economy would not work without our immigrant friends and family here in Eastside San Jose. And absolutely, people are concerned. We saw that when we were doing the census, many families wouldn't come to the door. And that's unfortunately why we saw a loss of a congressional seat here in the state of California, because the rhetoric coming out of the federal government during that time, the right-wing rhetoric. And during that time, I was doing outreach to the immigrant community, and I'm still here today doing the same.
Well, you know, it's something, I think, of taking responsibility and putting yourself on the line, which you really have done by participating in actions that bring attention by the federal government. But for your own personal experience and your own life, you know, as Spanish-speaking member of the community, as a Latino, what inspired you to take the actions you've taken? What's at the root of it?
You know, at the end of the day, all of our families, besides the indigenous, right, are immigrants. And if we look back in history, the Mexicano Native Americans used to pass up and down the imaginary borders that this government had instituted. And who are we to say who can come in and out of this country? This country essentially was founded by immigrants, right? Immigrants who unfortunately took this land from the indigenous populations, many who they're restricting from entering these borders. My grandfather, he worked hard to come to this country. He's a Salvadoreño, and you know, hearing former President Trump's rhetoric against the Salvadorians, saying they're gang members, they're all connected to MS-13, that really struck hard for me, because my grandfather worked hard. We have a lot of immigrants who are working hard. They're not criminals. They're just trying to come here to protect their family and provide their children a better opportunity at life. So, you know, I put myself in their shoes. I put myself in the shoes that, you know, individuals crossing the border are in. And I say, if they could do something so brave, I could at least do advocacy on their behalf.
Thank you so much, Mr. Councilman. This is, you know, quite a moment, and I appreciate your time taken here to give us, you know, heartfelt information and your perspective. Muchísimas gracias. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Miguel Gavilan Molina for the Pacifica Network and Flashpoints. And we have here present with us the executive director of CHIRLA, that's a Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, Angelica Salas. Angelica, thank you for being with us here today. I heard you talk earlier and it really moved me. Pero for yourself, tell us a little bit about CHIRLA and its mission and purpose.
So CHIRLA was started in 1986, and its mission is to create a just society fully inclusive of immigrants. The organization is composed, it's a mass membership organization of immigrants, many of them undocumented and immigrant families, students in high school and college, fighting in order to change our laws so that they're more just and more humane.
Wes, you came here with a delegation from Los Angeles. What inspired you to travel this distance to come to join the people here in San Jose on their walk to San Francisco's federal building?
Well, I think the commitment and the courage of the people who are walking in San Jose is what inspired us. And we've been fighting together for immigration reform. We have an opportunity to move legalization through an update in the registry, which is called the statute of limitations in immigration law, and update the date so millions of people could actually be legalized in this country. And so the folks in San Jose said, we want to do a pilgrimage to bring attention to the need for immigration reform, the need for legalization. And so this is, you know, they told us, you know, it's 40 miles in order for us to really bring attention to the fact that we haven't had immigration reform close to 40 years. So it's 37 years since the last immigration reform or legalization. And so what we want to make sure is that we were here, but not just from Los Angeles. There's also a group of folks from Central Valley who came up. And then a couple of folks are actually members here from the San Jose area who are also here. So it's a good group of us, but really are inspired by everybody who's out walking. And we're always inspired by San Jose. It's always been a very progressive region that always sets sort of the tone for also for the rest of California.
Pues, Angelica, for you, you know, you're in charge now of this incredible coalition that's been actively advocating for immigration reform for, I would say, years, if not decades. But here we are today. But for you individually, what moved you to get involved, you know, before Chitla? What was it that moved you, inspired you to say, I'm going to do something, I'm going to get involved with this, and I'm going to be part of it?
Well, I'm an immigrant from Durango. I came here as a small child, an unaccompanied child, you know, coming with my little sister and my uncle, who is 14, my aunt was 14, my uncle was 16 years old, to be reunited with my dad and my mom, who were working here in California as a garment worker, as construction worker. And we came to be reunited with them, but came here, you know, crossed the border like so many people do, and lived here in the country undocumented. My mom was a garment worker, so there was a, you know, work site raid in her factory. She was deported. I lived through that. Most of my family came to the United States without legal status. A lot of my family still doesn't have legal status. It really, we see it firsthand play out in our own lives. But I also lived through the experience of getting legalization, being undocumented, and then getting our papers through, whether it was the amnesty or other ways. And then you see how your life changes. And I saw how my life changed. My parents sacrificed so much. I was able to go to school. I was able to graduate from the university. But I learned from my parents and from other people, my mentors, that you gotta give back. Their sacrifice can't just be for me to have a better life, but for all of us to have a better life. And so I've been involved since the mid-90s became the executive director in my late 20s. And here I am, and I won't give up. I keep saying, you know, I'm not going to give up, but I'm also, I keep fighting because there's so many people that I work with who are the members of Chirla who are so much more courageous. And I just try to, you know, mirror their courage and their sacrifice.
It's a tremendous commitment in your part, and of course people gathered here today. Pero here we are, we're facing an unbelievable crisis in the country with the leadership out of Washington, D.C., and there's a lot of action around immigration. We've seen it. You know, and someone asked me, how many walks do we have to do? How many more times do we have to get involved in pilgrimages? What would be your response to someone saying that? We've been doing this. Where are we going? Where is this taking us?
Yeah. Well, I say, you know, the arc of justice, you know, for us, it takes a long time. It takes, but for the way that I think about it, it's marching. It's being public with our protest, and we have to do it. We have to do it as long as it takes until we win what we deserve, which is humanity and freedom. Because we're talking about people living in freedom and not being separated from their families and the tragedies of people being lost at our borders and die. And this is about life and death. So we have to do it as many times, but it's that with also getting out and registering to vote and participating in the voting process. It's about civic engagement, but it's also about advocating at local and state and federal levels for changes in the laws. So right now we're moving legislation at the state of California in order for our young people to have opportunities in higher education, for our high school students to get opportunities, but also for the undocumented elderly, folks who worked here all their lives, are still undocumented, don't have a safety net or retirement, that they have an opportunity and that they have some level of assistance. So we fight at all levels. It's not just this, but it's everything and this. And so to me, it's like when you know, there's something about being public with your protests, being public with your demands, being able to, like what we're doing today is people look and say, what are they marching about? What is it that they're protesting? And it really rises consciousness. It's about sacrifice. It's about showing that we're willing to sacrifice, put our bodies on the line in order for things to change.
Absolutely. one last quick message you like to send out there to people, and particularly young people? What would you say to them?
Yeah, that no social justice movement has ever won without young people. And so many times people say, you know, you're the leaders of the future. I always say you're the leaders we need now, because we need your energy. We need your talent. We need your creativity. We need your vision of the world, of a better world. And so I'm always inviting young people to be part of this fight. But I also tell all the folks who've actually been in this struggle for a long time, we need you too. We need your wisdom. So I really believe in multi-generational fighting for justice. So I say to the young people, we need you now, and to all the folks who've been at this for decades and decades, we still need you, and we need you even more because we need your wisdom, and we need you for us to be able to learn your lessons and the things that you've seen and witnessed, and also to be inspired to continue fighting.
Wow. Angelica, all I can say is thank you so much. Muchísimas gracias. That was the voice of Angelica Sales, the executive director for Chivlas, a coalition for humane and immigrant rights. Thank you so much. And we'll be talking in the future, Angelica. Thank you. Gracias. This is Miguel Gavilán Molina, reporting for the Pacifica Network and Flashpoints. Hoy día, today, I'm in San Jose, California. It is Saturday, August the 5th, 2023. I'm participating in a march for immigration reform, and particularly to look at the registry legislation. I'm sitting here under a tree taking a break. We still have about three more hours to go. Pero I'm here with one of the main organizers of this march.
Hi, yes, my name is Misraín Mendoza, and I'm a community navigator with Amigos de Guadalupe, Center for Justice and Empowerment.
Pues tell me, why did you become involved with this? What inspired you to take a commitment and be dedicated to this event here, and of course the march to San Jose to San Francisco?
So everything started with, we are in a committee or a group with Chirla, and I was in a meeting one day, and René Saucedo from Almas Libres y Raíces Colectivo anunció que iban a tener una caminata. And that inspired me, you know. So I got out of my office, and my little space that I work at, and I went to my director's office, and I says, we need to help. We need to support. I talked to René, and after that, she said, well, why we don't just march? Right? And I says, yeah, I want to go and support you up there. And one day they invite me to San Francisco to do a rally to talk about the registry. And in the registry, I says, you know what? I think San Jose should march with you guys too. So let me see what I can do. I call my friend Miguel Trujillo, Patty Vasquez, mi hermano Gustavo Flores, and they say, yes, we help you. So we started making phone calls. I talked to Stephanie Jane. She helped me so much to get funds for this to happen. And Amigos de Guadalupe has been supporting us the whole way, Chirla, and the community. The community, even the new immigrants coming in, as the kid you hear behind me saying, si se puede. He's a Colombian kid that just crossed the border, and he's saying, si se puede. He's making my day. So this is why I make it, because for kids like him, that they want a brighter future. And we've been in the shadows and in the dark for too long. I think it's too long. And if, like Marixa Maldonado says, if not us, who? If not now, when? You know? So that inspires me a lot. And my community inspires me a lot. And I think this is time. It's time when somebody steps up to the plate and says, let's do this. You know, so we all have to say thank you to the guerreras from Petaluma, honestly, because that's the ladies that started it all. We just complimenting them and showing them that in San Jose, we very, very good organizers, and we're coming out to help them.
Well, it was quite a turnout. And, you know, people are dedicated. There's a spiritual connection here, and that spiritual connection is, you know, as your t-shirt and as your hat says, Amigos de Guadalupe Center for Justice and Empowerment, friends of Guadalupe Latonatzin Centro for Justice and Empowerment. Outside of these actions, the organization Amigos de Guadalupe, are they constantly working towards empowering people through education, through other means?
Yes, and Amigos de Guadalupe, we believe that education is the greater equalizer, and that's going to get you places. But also Amigos de Guadalupe is very purposely hires people within the community and empowers them. We don't create followers, we create leaders. That's what Amigos de Guadalupe do. And purpose, they create leaders, literally. That's what they do. They create leaders, they trust us, they give us everything and all the tools that we need, from mental health to get us involved in the community, from cleaning the streets, helping the unhoused. We have so many different programs. The Amigos de Guadalupe, I swear, it's like no other.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirt Bag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Oh, what a world. KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.